Formula Access. Hey, today, you guys, we got a really, really cool guest. I've tried really, really hard to always bring a guest on from Formula One or IndyCar. Somebody that is influential in the sport and a new title. Today, we have a new title. Today, we've got Thomas Langford. He is a young man. He is extremely authentic. You guys, this is something that I just get really, really excited about, is when people are willing to say things and tell stories that they don't necessarily put out there in the public space. Again, no proprietary IP, no secrets, no rumors, no news. However, people's stories are fascinating. And the more that they open up when they tell these stories, I know the more that you connect with them as an audience. So you guys, I try really, really hard to find these types of guests. Thomas checked every box and did exactly what we needed him to do. He's awesome. Enjoy. Formula Access, welcome. I told you I would bring the people of motorsports. Yet again, another title. I've not duplicated a single title in all of this. You guys, it is my goal to bring a new role every single week to your doorstep. I've been scouring the world of F1 to bring just a very unique blend of people for you to get to know. And I got a special one today. Today we have Tom. He is our first proper guest from Red Bull Powertrains. I'm really excited to bring him here because I've really, really gotten enamored with the engine side of the business. And, you know, we've had somebody on from Mercedes, and I'm really excited to get a different vantage point of powertrains in general, also from another team. Tom Langford, welcome. Thank you for being here.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's a pretty surreal experience to come on a podcast. So yeah, thank you very much for having me.
We have a really, really healthy audience. I've honestly, like, in this, I've never had a bad comment. Now that I say it, somebody will probably do it for fun, but I have got the healthiest following, and I'm just like really, really honored to have that. And it's rare. So You're in safe hands here. I'm excited for you to be here. And honestly, like, when you responded, I got excited. I always get excited, but I appreciate it. So Tom, just to update the audience, high level, what do you do in Formula One today?
Okay, so hi everyone. I'm Tom Langford. I'm an assembly technician at Oracle Red Bull Racing, and I work in the Red Bull Powertrains department, which is their new engine department, developing the engines for 2026.
So you're on the 2026 engine. You're not working on the current setup.
No. So, we do have a certain department that, you know, works on the you know, servicing the current Honda power units that are currently powering the, you know, the Red Bull cars, as you have seen this season. But my main job is to develop the 2026 power units for when Red Bull Powertrains put their first ever sort of production or first ever power unit into the back of their own chassis, which is obviously quite an exciting step in, you know, an exciting progression for Red Bull Racing as a team, because, you know, it allows them to finally have all the pieces of the puzzle together, you know, and perfect sort of chassis and engine integration, rather than taking an engine from, you know, from a supplier and being a customer.
I'm blown away. My hesitation was, I actually wasn't expecting that. But I'm blown away about how many people are involved, like 3 years away. I had Dan Jones, who's the head of power unit concepts for Mercedes, on the show a couple of weeks ago. I think in like 2 weeks it'll air. And like how much effort goes into the future blows my mind. It makes me so excited about this sport that they think that far in the future. I'd be worried about like, you know, March at this point. And you guys are thinking, you know, 2026.
I think it's just in Formula One, it's such a competitive sport that you have to, you know, in order to beat your competition, you have to be thinking years in advance because you set yourself such high targets, or we as a department, as a team, you know, set such high targets for ourselves that, you know, in order for us to achieve those ambitious targets, we have to start early in order to give ourselves the best preparation, the most learning, and get all the proper procedures in place, as well as, you know, obviously developing an engine that's going to, you know, hit our targets and achieve success for Red Bull. You know, ultimately our goal is to win championships and be competitive straight off the bat. So in order to do that, we need to get on straight away.
You're doing a good job.
Thanks.
What exactly does an assembly tech do on the engine side?
So for me, I work in the sub-assembly department, or what we call internal combustion engine assembly. So I'm building all of the sub-assemblies of the engine, along with my colleagues, obviously, it's not just me. So we build, you know, the cylinder heads, turbochargers, all the pumps, so your scavenge, water, oil pumps, squirt jets, you know, fuel systems, hydraulics, you know, all of these sorts of components that, you know, help the engine work and function as it's expected. And then once we've built those components, they're then tested. Once they're built, we send them to the dynos, which are a different department of the same building, and they performance test that single component. And then after it's passed, you know, and met the performance expectations of that component, which is obviously specified by the engineers, it's then brought back to us. We just check it over just to make sure that everything's okay with it. And then we send it over to our next department, which is engine build, or ICE build. ICE standing for internal combustion engine. And then ICE build will then obviously build the entire assembly of the engine, put it all together, where it's then again sent back to the dynos after they've fully built it, and then tested again as an entire unit. And then obviously, yeah, it's then, you know, put into the back of a race car, or for our, you know, situation with development, obviously we can't test the cars at the moment. We can't put an engine in the back of a car because obviously testing is restricted in Formula One. So all we're allowed to do is run on the dynos, and then in terms of development, we bring it back. And then if we encounter any problems, or we feel we can push the boundaries, or, you know, push the performance of the engine any further, then the engineers will come up with other concepts, other ideas to try. And that's how the kind of development cycle works for us at the moment.
So you the engineers will create, let's just talk a fuel pump. The engineers will create a CAD drawing of a fuel pump. You guys will build it and then send it off to dyno to have it tested, and then you'll pop it over to almost the completion.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of people involved. Again, that's one of the things that, you know, really, you know, open, you know, really surprised me. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things you expect it in Formula One because it's like the top level, it's like the top echelon of the sport, that, you know, motorsport in general. So you kind of expect it, but nothing can really prepare you for like the infrastructure and the manpower and like the, you know, the amount of people that are all working as a collective into one finished product. You know, it's incredible. There's so many different engineers, technicians, you know, like stores people that, you know, obviously operate all the stores and give us the parts we need. There's parts coordinators that, you know, book out the parts and then deliver them to us. You know, there's just so many different people that work under the same roof to achieve this one target. It is incredible. It really does open your eyes into the kind of the world of Formula One. It really does. It's crazy.
I mean, you've also, like, I've looked over your LinkedIn profile. You've worked for some of the biggest teams in the sport. Like, how is this role different with the different teams? Does it, is it the same thing? Like, is it pretty cookie cutter or?
No, it is quite different. I mean, early on in my career, I started off just obviously doing work experience, and I was quite fortunate to get some work experience at some good teams. You know, people that follow Formula One more often than not follow Formula Two and things like that as well, Formula Three. And I got some work experience at Carlin, which, you know, run cars in Formula Three and Formula Two, as well as other sort of open wheel series as well. Mm-hmm. And so I did, you know, some work experience there, which obviously got, you know, really got me my first taste of working in motorsport. And then through college, I also got some other work experience at a touring car team called West Surrey Racing, or WSR. And touring cars is just, you know, sort of saloon car racing, but it's a really high level motorsport category in the UK. It's like the top national series in the UK. So yeah, did some work experience, which then turned out to, you know, develop into a number three mechanic role, which, yeah, was again my first proper job in motorsport. It was part-time, but it was my first taste of actually being part of a team. And then through that, you know, through networking again, I then went on to do a little bit of contractor work for McLaren. It was only for a week, but it was my first, you know, my first work abroad, which was really, you know, was amazing and quite daunting as well. It was the first time I'd ever traveled, you know, overseas by myself, and had to like negotiate to get into certain places to be with the rest of my colleagues at the time. You know, flying by yourself, you know, getting a hire car, driving to the venue of where, you know, where we were testing a GT3 McLaren 720S I was working on. So yeah, that was crazy. And then obviously, then eventually ending up in work, you know, working in Formula One, it has been a big roller coaster, actually. Like, I haven't had a motorsport career for very long. It has been quite up and down. But I'm on the up at the moment. So yeah, it's been really good. But yeah, early on, yeah, like I said, working for WSR, that was my first sort of trackside experience. So I did work at the factory, but I also did the work, because it's a smaller championship and a smaller team than where I currently work. As an employee there, you have to do both. You have to do the preparation at the factory, but then you also have to do the racing itself at the track. And yeah, that was very hands-on, very fast paced. And then now being in Formula One, your role is a bit more specific. It's, you don't get to do everything. You kind of, you don't become necessarily just a specialist in one area, but you work in a more specific area of the team, and which, you know, helps you sort of become like, you know, well, gets you to a sort of level where you can, you know, master that particular craft and then move on, hopefully, to another department, and then, you know, you develop your skills in that area as well. Whereas I think earlier on in my career, it was more about being a jack of all trades, trying to be, you know, trying to get to a, you know, a good high level, but being able to do every area of car preparation and running and sort of stuff like that. So that's where it hasn't been cookie cutter at all. It's just, I think earlier on in your career, you have to probably work a bit harder, in the sense of it's longer hours and things like that, and you're doing more, and it can be exhausting in that sense. But as you go up the motorsport ladder, it gets a bit more organized and just gets not chilled out, but just a bit more like bit more routine, I suppose, in a way.
So of all of the shows that I've done, I've actually had a number of people that have tried to get jobs at McLaren. So rest assured and build yourself up, because you're the only person, albeit a week, or the only person that has gotten a job at McLaren of all the people I've had on the show, including Lando Norris's dad. I had him on this morning, and he said he tried to get a job out of school with McLaren to get into Formula One, and they wouldn't take him. So obviously he had a different way in. Long down the road, but you made it. Good
yeah.
job. That yeah, says I something mean, about your capabilities.
Yeah, in motorsport, it's it I don't want to put the wrong message across, but it's very networking based. You know, it's very important to, you know, to like make sure that you put yourself out there and you talk to different people and make yourself known, kind of thing, because they're obviously, and obviously you have to impress these people and, you know, work hard and, you know, do a good job for them. But a lot of the time it's the friends that you make along all the way that can open, you know, doors later on in your career as well. Like the friends you make, you know, if you say, for example, you're a contractor based employee or just an employee at any team, you know, and you're fancying a change or whatever, you know, there's friends that you meet along the way that can that you can contact and say, look, have you got any jobs going where you're working? And these people open doors for you. So it's really important in motorsport just to make sure that, yeah, you put yourself out there and work hard and really get to know people and make friends, basically.
And I'd say, you know more than I do, but I would say that the sport in general is very approachable. And, you know, contrary to the belief of, you know, it's on its ivory tower, it is very, very approachable and people are willing to help others out, you know, assuming that you fit the mold, you know, you're a master of your craft, you work hard, you know, you're creative. I agree with you. I think networking within motorsports is how things get done and how you move up the ladder. I've also, of all the people that I've talked to about how they entered motorsports or Formula One, has been an email to somebody, you know, a social media message to somebody, or a letter, like a handwritten letter, which obviously that was a more senior role in a different era, but I totally agree with you. Red Bull to me feels like a tech startup. You know, they're very agile. They adapt really, really well. I feel like they foster innovation and move really, really fast, which means, like, from a business standpoint, that they empower their people to kind of think outside of the box and try things and execute. Do you see that internally?
You definitely notice that internally. I think one of the advantages of Red Bull, and something that's Christian Horner himself, as I've seen in podcasts and also as he's spoken to us about in race weekend debriefs, he said that one of the advantages of Red Bull is the fact that, you know, they're not an OEM like a Mercedes or a Porsche or anything, you know, Audi and stuff like that. They don't have, you know, to constantly be in line with the reputation of, or you know, be in line with their reputation of being formal all the time. You know, we as a team, I think, have a, you know, we're known as like a party team kind of thing. It's a bit more fun, it's a bit more relaxed and things like that. Obviously, don't get me wrong, like, we're very professional, we work hard and we're very determined and very driven to achieve the goals that we set ourselves, but we also like to have fun along the way. And I think one of the things that Christian Horner has expressed is that you know, he likes the fact that we're able to react quickly because we don't necessarily have to consult, you know, loads of board members in order to make a decision. We're a very punchy team in terms of being able to just, you know, react on the fly. And I think that comes across also in the race weekends as well. You know, like, our decision making and our strategists often come up with you know, decisions that often win us the race and have given us advantage in certain situations. And I think that's just kind of one of the many sort of strengths and like ethoses of the team, really, is just that, you know, we're able to make quick split second decisions. And you won't always get it right, but I think that the good thing about Red Bull is that we're not afraid to try, we're not afraid to make that decision, and if it pays off, then, you know, brilliant, we can applaud ourselves for that. But if it doesn't work out, then at least we're learning something. It's better to make a decision and get it wrong than to sit back static and not learn anything at all. So I think, yeah, definitely that's one of the advantages of Red Bull as a team.
Before I end this podcast, I want Hannah on the show. Like, I want to know what makes this high functioning human tick. I mean, what she does on the strategy side is unbelievable, and how, like, just what makes her tick. That's my show. Is like, yeah, what makes Hannah tick, and how does she execute that strategy, like, that wins championships?
Yeah, I mean, I've never met her personally, and I've only been working at the team, you know, for Red Bull since May. So I can't speak for her or even necessarily the people that have worked along, you know, directly alongside her. But obviously watching the races from home or from the factory, it's so impressive. And she, yeah, I do admire her a lot, because she really is, like, not only, you know, top of her game, but she's also proven, you know, that you should be, you know, diversity in motorsport, and she's, like, paving the way for women in motorsport. So it's a real inspiration for, you know, for other people that hopefully, you know, are looking for career, you know, looking for careers in Formula One and other categories as well, that, you know, that, and she's proven that, you know, this sport's open to anyone, and anyone can be the best at it. So I think it's great. But obviously it's not just her as well. There's other members of the strategy team that, you know, help her make those, you know, all work together to make those split second decisions. It's not all down to one person. So, you know, the whole strategy team is incredible. And you know, we get race bonuses for victories and things like that. So we actually, you know, there's been a few races this year where we have to thank them for the bonuses that we've fortunately been able to get through, you know, race winning strategies that they've come up with. So might have to get them a drink at the Christmas party or something.
How important, I mean, maybe this is a stupid question, but, like, how important is the role of an assembly tech? I mean, I almost feel like that role involves just as much pressure as, like, Christian's job, albeit different, but the same level of pressure, because you're creating something on the fly. You know, you're a little bit more future oriented, but, you know, you're still moving very, very quickly, even though it's very, very far in the future. But you got to get it right, you know, and I think, like, you are a layer of checks and balances to make sure that when that component comes off a computer and becomes an actual tangible thing, that it's correct and that it is successful on the dyno. Like, do you feel that, or is it pretty laid back?
I definitely felt that when I first started in Formula One. And yes, it does come with pressure, of course. But when I first got into Formula One, I was still relatively, I've been very lucky to kind of get into Formula One at quite a young age and quite early on in my career. I've been a person that's, you know, suffered with, well, I say suffered, but I've always had, like, a little bit of self-doubt and confidence issues and things like that. And I remember when I first started at Mercedes, you know, Formula One team, I worked at High Performance Powertrains, where they build the engines for the Mercedes powered teams. And my first day there, I remember thinking, like, am I in way over my head here? Like, I don't know if I can, you know, build Formula One components. Like, they're the most high level, like, high tech and sophisticated components in the world. Like, how is someone like me with, you know, minimal, you know, like, very early experience into motorsport going to be able to build one of these? But it's the people around you that I was lucky enough to go, you know, to go into the department, and the people there were so welcoming and, like, so helpful and so friendly that they kind of, you know, eased my nerves. And then I was able to let myself kind of, you know, jump in and get involved. I'm a very determined person. And I think once I really put my mind to something and I apply myself, I can do anything. But in the past, it's been just proving that to myself. That's, I think, where the self-doubt comes from a little bit. I have to prove it to myself before I know I can do it.
You don't believe that now, do you?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. Like, oh, you know, especially when you're doing something new that you haven't done before. And obviously, like you said, there's a lot of pressure that comes with the job, and you want to get it right, and you want it to be perfect, and you don't want to break anything because you're aware of the costs of all of these components and things. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure that you put on yourself to get it right. Like, you don't want to cost the team any time or money. So yeah, even now that you get doubt creeping, but it's just one of those things that you kind of have to remind yourself sometimes that, you know, you've gotten this far. There's no reason that you can't, you know, do this job or whatever. So, but yeah, I think, in answer to the main question was that, yeah, you do feel a certain amount of pressure to get it right. And obviously in Formula One, you have very specific targets in terms of how the component in itself has to perform. And you know, there's very tight, like, windows or tolerances that you have to work within. So for example, we build components that have where the internal was, say, for example, a scavenge pump, there's very tight tolerances of the internal workings of that pump that, the clearances that you're working to are down to the micron. You know, they're down to like 10s or 20 microns, which and a micron is a thousandth of a millimeter. And just for reference, I think a human hair is like 87 microns or something like that, and we're working to a tolerance of, you know, between 10 and 30 microns, so thinner than a human hair. And these are the sort of, you know, these are the sort of windows that you're having to work to, you know, to build the component within the, you know, these certain parameters, and you have to get it right. Otherwise it could mean that, you know, the component itself performs bad or even doesn't work. So yeah, you have to do the job right, and you have to do it to the deadline, but it has to be consistent in the terms of, it has to be perfect first time, every time, you know? And obviously, yeah, you learn along the way, and there are certain sort of mistakes that you make earlier on, or at any point in your career, you can always, make a mistake or whatever. But yeah, it's just about trying to be as perfect as you can sort of every time. And fortunately I've been quite lucky in the sense of I haven't really messed anything up drastically yet. Touch wood, I hope I never do. But it's about having a good team around you when things do go wrong, that you've got the right people around you to, you know, to help you fix it, or, you know, whatever, or just, you know, make sure that you can do it perfectly, or you can do it right first time. It's, you know, if you do need help with something, I've always experienced when I've been in Formula One and in all teams I've worked for in motorsport, I've always had a good support network around me to help me do the job that I need to do. And yeah, that's the good part about being in a team environment. You know, you've always got people around you to support you. You never have to do anything by yourself. So yeah, that's one of the parts of motorsport and Formula One that I really enjoy.
When you have your role for more of the current design, or like the current engine, and the engine lets go, which is a really rare problem for you guys, do you ever kind of sit back, like if you're at home watching the race, like do you ever sit back and go, did I do that? Like, did I not tighten the bolt? Did I not check something? You know, what were the tolerances? Or do you guys have so many checks and balances that no one person really ever feels or ever questions that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah. So there are plenty of like safety nets, if you will, like along the way. So, you know, you'll build a component, and then often in sub-assembly where I work, there'll be a second check step. So you'll get one of your colleagues to check your work and make sure that it's all working properly before you send it to the dynos. And obviously the dynos then performance test it to make sure it's working to its specified parameters. And then obviously it'll come back and you check it again to make sure that they haven't, you know, accidentally, torn an O-ring or something like that, in taking the pump on and off from, or whatever component it is, taking it off of the rig. And then, yeah, you'll check it and then take it and send it to engine build, and then engine build will fit it to the engine, which then again, it gets performance tested again. So there's lots of safety nets along the way that enable you to spot a problem way before it's even introduced to the car. But obviously, in my time in motorsport, in my time in Formula One, there have been times where, when I was working at Mercedes, at HPP, I was in pump section there. So I was building, yeah, like I said, the pumps before, like water pumps, oil pumps, all that kind of stuff. And then I remember in 2021, George Russell had a water pump failure in free practice. I think it was Azerbaijan Baku or something like that. So yeah, and I remember watching the TV thinking, oh my God, like, please don't let that be one of my pumps. Like, and then, yeah, and you go in to work on Monday morning, and the first thing I did, I went up to, you go up to your team leader and you ask like, have you heard any news on that water pump or whatever? And then they'll either tell you like, yeah, don't worry, it wasn't your fault, or we have to investigate or whatever. And sometimes you'll get it back that week to have a look and see, to strip it and look internally and see if there's anything that, could have caused it and whatnot. So there are times where you think where you're praying that it wasn't anything that you did. But like I said, it's quite rare for it to be pinpointed to one specific person. I'd say there's more pressure on that at the track side, really, because I think obviously there's a lot of car prep that goes on a Thursday, Wednesday, Thursday, on the lead up to, the Friday practice and qualifying and then the race. Like, there's probably more pressure on the technicians there than there is, say, at the factory.
Your team boss doesn't mess with you and put the fuel pump on your desk when you come in Monday morning? And
I personally haven't had that happen to me, but yeah, I mean, that you do get kind of, back with working banter like that at work. And some, obviously, I remember at Mercedes, I had, a good team leader that, would have done something like that to one of us. Had something like that gone wrong at the track, he would have, teased us or taken the piss or whatever. And we would have laughed about it, but obviously, obviously they do look at it a bit, not as in a lighthearted sense, if it's cost us a sort of race position or something like that, or, it's an obvious mistake or a repeated mistake. Obviously it can be something that, you can get into trouble for. But like I say, fortunately it's never happened to me, and I haven't, to be honest, in Formula One, I've never seen, any sort of disciplinaries that, handed out for that sort of thing. Everyone's very professional and takes their job very seriously. So it doesn't tend to really happen, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think Formula One breeds a culture of people just looking for a paycheck. I think people that are there are really passionate and take ownership of their project or their component or whatever they're doing to that car. And I think that they own it from the moment that they hand it off to the moment it crosses the finish line. I absolutely see that with everyone that I talk to. Nobody's messing around in this sport, and nobody is, kind of like, I don't know, half-assing anything. And that's what I love about this sport, is it's a pure meritocracy, and the entire organization is just pushing as hard as they can. How did you get into motorsports? Like, when did this journey begin for you, where you said, I want to be in Formula One? And how did you arrive at like what you wanted to do within the sport?
So basically my passion for motorsport began when I was really young, and I watched it on a Sunday with my dad. He's the one that got me into Formula One. He watched it long before I was born, but he always watched it on a Saturday, Sunday. And I, as a little kid, I can remember, the fact that, because my dad was so interested in it and tuned into it every time it was on, that the repetition of it kind of got me interested. And then I started to watch it with him more, and to the point where as I grew up, the passion grew. And then, I just became more and more involved. And then to the point where I started to surpass his knowledge of the sport and things like that. And it really, my love for it really took off. But like I said, I've always put it on a pedestal. I never really imagined that it was an achievable target. I never really imagined myself working in there. So when I left school, I was also very interested in joining the military anyway. So those were my two main passions in in life or in early life sort of thing. I loved motorsport, but again, I didn't really see it as an achievable goal for myself. So I focused my energy on joining the British Army, which I eventually did when I left what we call college in the UK, but it's high school in US terms. And I joined the British Army, and I invested sort of, you know, all my focus in that. And I wanted to do that for, you know, for several years, you know, leading up to the point where I actually joined. And when I actually joined, it wasn't what I was expecting it to be, and I wasn't as good as I perhaps imagined myself to be. I'd been in army cadets for, you know, which is like a, you know, an extracurricular activity in the UK, and you kind of like train, you train as a soldier in the sense of like you learn sort of map and compass and, you know, like rifle shooting and all that kind of thing. And yeah, and I you know, it fed into my passion for that, and then I decided to do it for real and join the army. But like I didn't excel at it as I thought I would. And so I left that, and then I was in quite a bad place mentally for a little while after that. I don't really tell many people about it actually, because I was quite embarrassed about it for a long time. My family, you know, gave me a big send off before I left for training and things like that. And a lot of my friends came, and when I left, because I was not as good as I thought I was, and I really hated it there. Like, you know, at the training camp, and I really struggled, like, you know, mentally. And then when I left, I also, again, it compounded that kind of depressive feeling, because I felt like I'd let my family down and let my friends down and things like that. And I just, yeah, wasn't feeling very good about myself for a little while. And then obviously I didn't know what to, that was my career. I'd planned to do that, you know, when I left school. So I left education. So I was a bit lost for what to do, really. And then I spoke to my parents, and obviously, you know, expressed this feeling of kind of emptiness of, now I don't know what to do with my life sort of thing. And they said, well, you've always loved motorsport, like, you know, why don't you go for a career in that? And I thought to myself, like, you know, like, why didn't I think about this sooner, you know? And I'd always loved it, but I just never really tried, you know. I always thought it was out of reach, but I hadn't actually tried. So anyway, I looked into, education and being able to, you know, what does it take to get into motorsport? And obviously you go online and you look at it, and a lot of the people that are involved have some sort of, you know, qualification in something, you know, in some form of engineering that has enabled them to then take that into motorsport. So I went to Brooklands College, which is a college, it's sort of around, well, near McLaren. It's kind of west of London, in like West Surrey sort of thing. And which is, the county that surrounds London, or south of London. So I went to college there and studied motorsport engineering. And that's where I kind of, this was my second attempt at college. I was paying for it this time, because we get the first, it's like high school. So I had to pay for it the second time, because I'd already been once before. Mm-hmm. And so I was studying motorsport engineering there, and I was a bit older. I was a bit, obviously, you know, had got a job in a petrol station after I left the army and all that. And I decided then I wanted to go into motorsport, and I was a bit older than my classmates, so I took the class probably a little bit more seriously than a lot of other people in the class did. Some of them, not all of them, obviously. And I think that is why what really enabled me to get the most out of that course. And that's why I got put forward for a lot of the work experience opportunities that came out of that course. And that's how I sort of started. And that's where I got my job at WSR, doing, the Touring Car Championship. And then built up my experience there, worked there for 2 years, and then moved on to do some contractor work at McLaren. And then obviously the COVID pandemic hit, and unfortunately I was made redundant from WSR, and that was probably where my motorsport career hit a real low point, because I felt like I kind of got a bit complacent at WSR and felt like, oh, I've got my foot in the door now. I don't really, you know, no one can take this away from me. I feel like it can only get better. And then obviously, like I said, the pandemic hit and then I lost my job and was made redundant. And then obviously the motorsport world continued and they all the championships obviously tried to carry on the sport once the pandemic had kind of settled down and COVID protocols had set in and they tried to resume. But obviously a lot of the people that had lost their jobs in motorsport then were trying to get back in, and me being one of those people, and I found it very difficult. I struggled for a long time. I was applying for loads of different jobs and, you know, online and not hearing anything back. I was driving around to loads of different motorsport teams and handing out my CV. Not getting any sort of reply, because a lot of the teams, they were a bit nervous about getting people from outside the bubble into the factory to work, just because they didn't want to obviously put their current employees at risk. So I didn't get anywhere. I was obviously very disappointed with the way that I felt my career was turning out. And I was at that point, I was prepared to completely give up on motorsport. I was, I thought to myself, well, I've lost my opportunity and I know I can't even get back into it. So, I think, and at that point I was getting a bit older. I was approaching 25 years old, and I thought, I was looking at all my other friends around me, not people that worked in motorsport, but my friends from school that all had their career jobs and things like that. And they were all moving on with their life and, you know, succeeding in their careers. And I looked at myself as a 25-year-old and thought I expected better of myself than this. I didn't expect myself to be unemployed or, you know, and trying to hunt for a job and not getting anywhere. You know, I was really, again, disappointed in the way it all turned out. And then, I had a really good support network around me with my girlfriend and my parents, and they just, you know, told me never to give up. And that's what really helped me to kind of push forward at that next step, which then I applied. The next application I did after that was for Mercedes on LinkedIn. I saw the opportunity come up. And again, I thought, oh, well, I haven't been lucky enough to get a job at any other team that I've applied for at grassroots level. So how am I ever going to get an opportunity at Mercedes? There's no way they're going to apply. But I thought, oh, you know, it costs me nothing. What have I got to lose? So I applied. And and that's when I got, a message from the recruiter saying, oh, you know, your CV is exactly what they're looking for. Would you be interested in an interview? And I was like, Formula One, of course, yes, of course I'd be interested in an interview. Give them my CV now, sort of thing. And leapt at it. And then obviously did the interview, and that was really nerve-wracking as well, sitting in front of two engineers and them asking me technical questions about, you know, what I knew about, you know, engines and how to build them and stuff. And I was, you start to, when you've got two experts in their industry asking you about, you know, asking you technical questions, you start to second guess yourself and think, do I actually know that? Fortunately the interview went better than it probably was apparent to me anyway. I ended up getting a call the next day saying I got the job. So I think for anyone listening, I suppose the lesson I'd probably want them to take away from that is just never give up. If you've got even if it's not related to motorsport, if you've got any dreams of working in a specific industry or anything like that, the main thing I want people, I know it sounds really cheesy, but I feel like I have experienced this kind of in a certain way in my own life, that you really can't give up. And I was just really thankful I was really lucky that I had the support network around me to keep me going, because I definitely would have given up. So and like I said, the next team I applied, you never know what's around the corner, and the next team that I applied for was Mercedes, and I got it. So it was just and that's what I mean at the beginning when I said that my journey's been a bit of a roller coaster. It's on a high now, but I there were certain points where I thought it was all over, and I definitely wasn't feeling very good about myself. So
I have to interject here and say thank you for your service. We're not in the same country, but
yeah,
you're serving your country, and that's honorable. Second,
I don't want to take too much credit for that, because like I said, I didn't pass the training. So I don't believe anyone needs to thank me for any sort of service at all. I didn't get in. So, you know,
you volunteered. You volunteered. It's like starting a company and failing. It happens to 90% of people that start a company, but the hardest part is actually quitting your job and doing it. And so it is still, to me, just as honorable to take that step. Second off, like, all your parents ever want from you, I'm a dad, all your parents ever want is for you to chase your passions. So like, if you fail at something, at least you fail and learned and moved on. Like that to me is always something I want to instill in my children. And I want them to know, like, they're never gonna get any pressure from me to like be successful in everything that they do. I just want them to chase their passions. And, you know, if they ever fail or trip, that they get back up and keep going. And like, you got a girlfriend that's going to walk with you through fire like that, don't let her go.
Yeah. I'll let her know you said that. She'll she won't let me forget that one, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's rare. Okay. So it's rare. So when you find that person that's willing to walk through, you know, a war zone with you, you hang on tight.
Yeah. I have to credit her, to be honest. Cause yeah, like I said, I was so close to giving up. Like I applied for another job, and that wasn't related to motorsport at all, because I thought to myself, like, I have to move on with my life. Like, I'm 25 years old, you know, I've got to do something. I'm old enough now where I should have a career. And it's one of those things, you see other people around you that, you know, and you start to compare yourself to them, and people tell you, you know, don't, you know, everyone takes life at different paces, and you should never compare yourself to other people. But it's only natural for people to kind of look elsewhere and think, oh, they've got it, you know, they've got it good over there. You know, why aren't I at that stage as well? And I definitely felt like that, you know, with my friends. And that's why I felt like I had to be at a certain point in my life by the age of 25. And that's why I applied for, you know, I applied to be a telecommunications engineer, you know, installing people's broadband in their house. And I have no passion for that whatsoever. I really wasn't looking forward to it. And that's, you know, that's why my girlfriend and my mom and, you know, everyone said, you know, you can't give up. Like, you have to go for it. You know, I was in a fortunate enough position to, you know, to have the people around me to, you know, to allow me to keep going. Cause I know everyone's not always fortunate to be able to make those, you know, to have that situation around them where they can, you know, put their career on hold and really go for what they want. Some people have to, you know, earn the money now because they've got responsibilities like children or a roof to put over their head. So again, I was very, very lucky to have the people around me, but also be in a situation where, you know, I could go out and hunt for a job rather than earn money to pay for things that I was responsible for. So yeah, I was just very, very lucky.
So you've been in Formula One for a minute. What's been your pinch me moment so far?
Obviously, I would like to, my long-term goal is to be trackside. I don't, you know, I love working at the factory. It's chilled in the sense of, like, you know, there's not that intensity of having the competition immediately in front of you and having, you know, cameras around you, loads of fans and celebrities around you all the time, like Formula One does. Being a competitive person myself, I do want to feel that intensity. You know, I want to be one of those people that's at the track, you know, like working on the car there and then, and you know, watching from the garage as, you know, Max or, you know, Checo, you know, goes for the win, you know, goes for the overtake, goes for that pole position lap in qualifying. I want to feel that adrenaline, that excitement firsthand, and that's my long-term goal. But you know, my pinch me moment factory, you know, from being a factory based employee has probably been like when I've been sat in the canteen or the restaurant that we have at Red Bull, and I sat down to have my lunch, just, you know, innocently sitting there, I suppose, with a few of my colleagues. And, you know, I look across and two tables away from me is Max Verstappen and his engineer, you know, talking about, you know, their simulator session that they've just been on preparing for the next race weekend. And you look over there. And again, for, you know, that, you know, young boy in me, like, that watched Formula One from a young age with his dad and idolizing this sport, to being there like 20, 15 years later, you know, sitting a couple of feet away from a real F1 driver who at that point had won a world championship, you know, working for a Formula One team. It was just, yeah, like that was one of those things where I just couldn't believe where I was. Like, it was just absolutely incredible. I've always wanted to work in Formula One, so it's just, yeah, I can't really believe where I'm at the moment. It's just, yeah, it's amazing.
The whole thing is a pinching moment.
Yeah, it is. It is. I do love my job. Obviously, there's parts to it that, you know, are more fun than others. But I mean, that was always something that was really important to me as a person. I really wanted a job that, you know, I didn't want to go to work on a Monday morning or wake up on a Monday morning dreading, like, oh, I've got work again. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted to be one of those people that had a job that they loved and they were passionate for, because I feel like that's when I get the most out of myself as a person. You know, when I'm interested in something, you know, I was never the best in school. You know, when I was in high school, like with my friends, you know, and you're learning about maths or geography or whatever, I was never really that interested, you know, to the point where I would apply myself 100%. I was more interested in talking to my friends and having a laugh. But then, you know, when I got to college, or again, the US sort of high school level, and I was learning motorsport engineering, that was when I really took education seriously. And because I was actually studying something I was passionate about and really enjoyed. And it showed in my results. You know, I achieved good marks and good grades, and obviously it got the work experience, and which then turned into a job. I really put my 100% into it. And I felt like that's what I needed in a job. I needed something that I loved and cared about and was passionate about to really get 100% out of myself and get 100% out of the career itself, you know, like, you know, be successful financially, you know, be successful in terms of, like, you know, moving up the ladder in terms of, you know, hierarchy, I suppose, if you like, or the structure, and yeah, all of those sorts of things. And I just find it a very rewarding job, and I'm just, yeah, very, very lucky to be one of those few people that gets to work in it, because I know a lot of people want to, but not everyone gets to. And so I do, yeah, try to remember that all the time, because yeah, I'm lucky to be where I am.
So hold on, you guys are in college when we're doing high school?
Yeah, so we have, like, you know, preschool, and then we have primary school, and then you get to like 11 years old, and then you go into high school, and you're in high school until 16, and then we have what we call college, which is 2 years, so that's like, or sixth form, and that's when you're 17 or 18. You do 2 years there, and you're 17 onto 18, and then once you reach 18 years old, you then apply for university, or what you would call college, and that's where you're there for, you know, 3 years studying whatever degree you want there, and then after that you can do your master's and whatnot. But yeah, that we have those, those are the steps that we have.
So you effectively start college at the same 17, 18 years old that we,
yeah, did. We okay. We start university or college at 18. Yeah.
Okay. 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 I was like,
so yeah. Yeah.
That's a novel idea to start your career when you're 16 years old.
I think your high school, it goes up to 18, doesn't it? Whereas we have like an intermediate in between. We have a high school and then a college and then university, or yeah, what you call college.
Okay. Whew. I almost moved over there. not for me, but for my kid.
No, yeah.
I know they would appreciate that. What didn't you expect in Formula One? When you finally got there, you kind of achieved your lifelong goal and you're in it. What surprised you?
I don't know. That's quite a tough question, actually, I suppose. I mean, you things surprise you every day, like just the money that's involved. That's obviously a real big surprise, because you obviously know it's going to be a lot. Like I said, it's the top echelon of motorsport, but you know, it's, you know, the facilities, the people, like everything, you know, and then in some cases, like the wastage as well, like, you know, you use components for, you know, let's say like 2,000 kilometers of it running on the dynos, or you know, even a race weekend. I think a race weekend component only goes round, you know, is maximum life expectancy is like 800 kilometers for certain components, you know, things that you're not restricted in use of, like obviously engines, you only have three of those a year, but there's certain components that you can service items that you can change. And some of those, you know, a race weekend component, you know, can have like you know, 800 kilometers on it before it needs to be serviced or, you know, changed completely. And that, you know, that's one of the things that I think, obviously, the cost cap restrictions and, you know, like the, you know, the restrictions with engine use and gearbox use and things like that tried to limit, because I think back in the early 2000s, it was just ridiculous. You'd get qualifying engines that were one use only, and then they just get thrown away. So that's something that when I first started my motorsport career, that was really surprising to me, like sets of brake calipers and pads, you know, that, and, you know, brake discs that I think you would call rotors in the US, brake rotors. They get thrown away after very minimal use, whereas and you find out the cost of them, and they're like £2,000 each, or like two and a half thousand, you know, dollars, and you're like, oh my god, like, you know, I pay a quarter of that, you know, if not less, for the component on my road car, and it gets used for, you know, 50,000, 100,000 miles, whatever. So it's, yeah, it is quite surprising the life expectancy of some of the components you use before they get thrown away. And often they get thrown away and they look immaculate, they look perfect, but you throw them away because you know the performance has been taken out of them, and they're no good for racing, for competitiveness. So yeah, that was surprising to me.
So the people of F1 always have like a unique hobby. Do you have any like off track or off work hobbies?
I've always been a bit of a weird person, in the sense of I always have like one focus and one passion, and literally motorsport takes over my whole life. Like I love it a lot, but for some people it would probably come across as quite suffocating, because it's my hobby as well as my career. And then I come home and I play video games, of like, you know, I play the F1 racing games or whatever. So so to some people it might be quite suffocating, but for me I love it. But yeah, my hobby is karting. I don't do it at a high level, because I as we all know, motorsport is so expensive, but I do a few you know, higher kart national championships and things like that, where you use the track, you know, the circuit provided rental carts, and we all turn up and you know, race against each other in those, and it's a proper championship where, you know, the points are awarded and logged and all that kind of stuff, and it's a proper championship, but it's for people that, you know, can't afford sort of owner drivers karting or owner racing, where you own your own vehicle. I love it. It's amazing, and the thing is, it's because a lot of people are in the same situation where they can't afford their own racing car or their own go-kart. So you get the people that have the talent, have the competitiveness and all that sort of thing, all the things you need to be a good driver, but they just don't have the financial backing. And yeah, I put myself in that category where, like, I'm fairly good. I'm not like, you know, F1 driver level or F1 potential F1 driver talent level, but I'm okay. And I race against a lot of people that are, you know, are insanely talented as well. And they just don't quite have the backing to be able to take their career any further. So we all race at, you know, in these club level championships. And the racing is incredible. It is really good. And yeah, I love it. And that's my kind of escape from reality, even though it is my career and all that as well.
Yeah, we have rental leagues here as well. And club, yeah. You know, I guess club sports is what you refer them to. But my son and I do rental leagues together. And then he's got a cart that he, very low level, entry level, basically like the first level above a rental cart and no higher. Like I'm not going there. That's unbelievably expensive. I'm not going to go there, but I love the rental leagues because you can kind of just show up and race, whereas with his cart, you know, a race weekend is like you're battling tire pressure, suspension, I mean engine, your oil changes, your gear ratios change. I mean it's so much work. It's so much fun to do with him, but like I actually just like showing up, using their helmet, their go-kart, and then leaving. And I don't have to lug anything around or forget any tools or have to go buy parts. And it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately enough, I've been able to afford everything else, you know, like the race suit, the boots, the gloves, the helmet, and all that kind of stuff. But just, yeah, not the cart itself. It's just so expensive to run. But that's the good thing about it. When with the rental championships, you know, you turn up and you're all given the same equipment, and it's just all down to driver ability rather than, you know, when you go to higher levels of karting, especially owner drivers karting, it's all about, again, it's like mini Formula One. It's about who's got the biggest budget. Who has the newest chassis, the newest engine, the newest set of tires, and that's where you sometimes the talent, you know, gets a little bit lost. You can be overwhelmed by, you know, a competitor that's maybe not quite naturally as gifted as you, but has the financial backing. So, you know, with rental karting, it kind of removes that limitation in the sense that, you know, you're all given equal machinery, and you can kind of, you know, race against each other equally fairly, and improve, you know, prove what you've got, you know, and it's it, yeah, I love it. It's so good. And yeah, when other aspects of my life get a bit too much, I can kind of switch over to, you know, racing driver Tom, or pretend racing driver Tom, and, you know, kind of leave all that behind, and, you know, put the crash helmet on, and then go and race. And yeah, that's my kind of escape from, yeah, like I say, when everything gets a bit too much.
Well, next time you're eating lunch, just walk over to Max and say, "Hey, man, I've got this rental league. I need some tips. You know, can you come trackside and show me some pointers? And you know, I'll make sure your components work at the next race."
Yeah, oh mate, I'd love to bring him along to one of the races, because obviously I race against a lot of people that are huge fans of Formula One, and they went, you know, some people have found out, you know, that I work for Red Bull, and they, you know, ask, you know, different questions about how, you know, how work's going and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it would be amazing to bring a driver along, but I haven't even spoken to any of them yet. So I'm hoping to, you know, get a selfie with them or whatever, you know, speak to them a little bit at the Christmas party or something like that. Because we've got a Red Bull have got a good Christmas party coming up soon. Obviously, we've done quite well this year, as I'm sure, you know, some of the people watching will know. So I imagine it's going to be, you know, everyone's going to let their hair down and you know, really have a good time. So and it's my first F1 Christmas party. I mean, I've worked in it since. You know, I've worked in it since last year, since the beginning of last year, and you know, obviously COVID meant that Mercedes didn't have a Christmas party last year. So this Red Bull Christmas party is going to be my first ever one, and I've heard that they're pretty mental, you know, in terms of like the venues, the, you know, the, you know, like that, the performers that they get to obviously perform at the event and all that kind of stuff is pretty next level. So I'm really looking forward to it.
That'll be fun. So I always ask kind of at the tail end of the show, if so I've been writing in Quora for a couple of years, and you know, it's like Reddit question answer, and I get asked the question a lot, you know, people wanting to get into motorsport. How, like, what is that defining trait? Or if a young person came to you and said, you know, at the track, at a kart track, and said, "Man, you work for Red Bull, you know, that's my dream to be in the sport." Like, what do I need to know? Like, what advice would you give them?
Okay, so the first thing I'd say is obviously don't do what I did in terms of putting F1 on a pedestal and thinking that it's completely out of reach, because it's not, you know. I wouldn't say that obviously me joining the army at the early stage, you know, in my late teens, was the wrong thing to do. But had I, you know, really thought about what I genuinely, you know, really deep down wanted to do, I probably would have pursued a lot earlier on. And I'm not saying that I would have ended up in the same place, but you know, at least I would have had a bit more of a head start. But yeah, I'd say, yeah, so don't put it on a pedestal. Like, if you want to work in it, you can. Like, you just have to work really hard. The second thing I'd say is, you know, just, you know, perseverance. So like, as I've said before, with my own kind of journey, is that, you know, like there will be times where you get knocked back, or you think that, you know, oh, is it, you know, I'm applying for loads of different teams, or you know, I'm trying to get my foot in the door, work experience, whatever it is, and I keep trying, I keep getting to, you know, declined, or you know, I'm not hearing any replies. But the first thing you have to remember is just never to give up. And I know it sounds cheesy, but it really is true. Like, if you really have something that you really want to do, you can't ever give up. You just have to keep pushing and keep moving on. And
and yeah, and just keep trying, because eventually it will click, it will happen for you. The next thing I would say is just get yourself out there, really, like be proactive. A really good thing to get involved in motorsport is to especially in the UK, I'm sure this is the same in the US, is that we have these things called open track days. So a lot of the racing circuits like Silverstone that hosts the British Grand Prix, and we have other circuits like Brands Hatch, Donington Park and all that kind of stuff around the UK. They all have open track days where privateer teams come to test, but also like, you know, bigger teams, like, you know, manufacturer teams go to test their racing cars before the season. And, you know, these track days, these open track days, like, you don't have to pay to go in off more often than not. And you can usually get into the paddock fairly easily, because obviously it's not a competition, it's just an open track day, like, to test your car. So I think that's a really good opportunity to go in, to you go to the track, go to the paddock and put your head through the garage door and say, you know, hi, you know, can I speak to the team manager? And I think, you know, just networking and putting yourself out there, speaking to people and, you know, telling them that, you know, that's what you want to do is a really good way of getting to know people, but also getting your foot in the door. A lot of these teams, especially the smaller ones, the privateer teams, you know, do often need a helping hand. They do need an extra pair of hands just to, you know, organize sets of tires or, you know, clean the car in between sessions. So I think that's a really good way of just getting involved, you know, handing your CV out to them and making yourself known, making those teams aware that you're available and you're willing and you're keen and dedicated to having a motorsport career yourself. And it's like any sport, you have to work your way up. So you start off at these privateer teams, you build your experience there. Obviously they trust you, that they begin to trust you and know that, you know, and can see that you're dedicated to having a career and you're working hard. So they give you more responsibility within that team, that again broadens your skill set and your ability and your experience. And then you can take that to the next team that you move on to, hopefully a higher category or a role that has a bit more responsibility. And then you just keep building on that experience, building on those credentials on your CV, and then approach the next team. And eventually that's how you build your way up to Formula One. You know, no one just falls into Formula One as their first job. I mean, there may be some very lucky people that get into Formula One straight away. I mean, we've got apprentices at Red Bull that's their first motorsport job, is they've got, you know, got into Formula One straight away, and that's great. You know, they're very lucky, but it doesn't happen like that for everyone. And like, you know, sometimes you have to work for it and you have to build up to it. But obviously, you know, that journey makes the rewards even sweeter once you do get there. And it will happen for you. You just have to keep going. You know, those are the main sort of tips I would give someone starting out.
And I would also add your authenticity.
My headphones have died. Sorry.
Your authenticity probably takes you really far. I think it's rare to run into a young person. I mean, I'm old enough to be your dad. Like, it's rare to run into a young person that is willing to get on a podcast in front of a camera and talk about things that didn't go so well. And as somebody that employs people and is around recruiting, looking for people that are genuine and real and authentic is a quality that you need on a team, because those are the types of people that can, you know, they're not yes people. Yes people are like robots and they create a facade, like a fakeness, and you can't see actual problems that exist. And having people like you around uncovers those things so that you can be a Red Bull. And they have superseded what independent teams have been unable to do for a very, very long time at this level. It's been, you know, dominated by manufacturers and billion-dollar budgets. And, you know, Red Bull has built its own infrastructure from the ground up and broken all the rules because of people like you. So young people paying attention, you know, that's a rare quality. Pay attention to Tom.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I do, I don't always feel like I deserve praise like that, but yeah, thank you. I do appreciate it. It's nice of you to say.
When I started watching Formula One in 2004, there were so many robotic personalities that it was hard to watch. And when Red Bull acquired Jaguar and Christian Horner came in, and you know, Helmut Marko came in and Adrian Newey came in, and then you kind of get these personalities in the sport like Sebastian Vettel, and I think he kind of extracted some stuff out of Weber that you didn't see in him at other teams. And then, you know, and then you get Ricardo in the team, and that exposes even more kind of what Red Bull is today. And now you have Matt. I mean, it's a culture of, you know, getting out of your comfort zone, being authentic, being real, and pushing boundaries, and basically saying like, this is the way we've always done it, is not the way we're going to do it going forward. And I mean, you're a perfect culture fit for the team. So you deserve the praise. I don't just say that.
Thank you.
I don't need to say it. I mean it. So don't doubt yourself. Keep pushing your own boundaries. And, you know, I really think people will resonate with you, because I think what you experience as a 25-year-old is what every 25-year-old, 99% of 25-year-olds on the planet are challenged with. And there's nobody to say, get up, keep going. You know, they don't all have girlfriends that stick around and say, get up, keep trying. I got your back. I'm always here. We'll get through this. Yeah. And you're a lucky guy.
Yeah. 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 Believe me, I know it. Like you say, it pinch me moments all the time, every day. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, man, Tom, I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for not deleting my message and thinking this was a spam or a joke or a scam. I do want people on the show, and you were, you know, you were patient enough to work with scheduling and whatnot. So
is it great? No, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Sorry if I've rambled on a bit. I know obviously that middle part where I was talking about like when I first started and getting to Formula One and the ups and downs, I know that was probably talking for like 10 minutes. So yeah, sorry about that. But thank you very much for having me on. Like I said, I've really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to listening to future podcasts with other guests and stuff. So yeah, keep doing what you're doing as well. I really enjoy it. It's great.
It's been fun. The sport has been very, very supportive. And, you know, I initially sent out like 100 messages expecting like five to come back. You know, it's like, I'll do this quarterly. It's fun. And like 80 people responded back, and they're like, yeah, let's do it. You know, when can I come on? And it's been really cool, because it's instead of having five people of very, very, very different or very similar roles, you know, I think we've got 30 recorded episodes of just everywhere and all different facets of like vendors of the sport, content creators of the sport, you know, people in the teams, heads of teams. So it's been really neat to do that. I appreciate the comment. I'll keep pushing it out there. And, you know, when you go trackside, we're going to have you back on the show. So we can get that vantage point too.
Yeah, cool. I think that's one of the things that's really unique about Formula Access, is just that, yeah, it interviews everyone. And there's so many other people out there that, you know, don't always get the spotlight put on them, but they're equally as important to some of the people that have had the most success or whatever. So yeah, I think that's what's great about Formula Access, is that it talks to everyone. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we want them. Receptionists, we want everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody on the show, because you're all awesome. I've not run into a single person on this show where I'm like, yeah, I'm not really sure that's very impressive. Like, every person has a very unique, impressive story. And I know, because I've lived a lot of life, I know that that will encourage somebody. And that's the essence of the show, is to allow fans deeper into the sport, as well as hope and encouragement for young people. And you know, I hope even you can listen to it and stop doubting yourself and really be like, yeah, I've worked for the top teams. You know, I am something. So get after it. You deserve it.
I'm trying every day, you know.
Awesome. Tom, thank you for coming on. I really
thank you very much. Thank you.